Everything changes as soon as you start to really understand how something is growing, and the time that it takes to get it there. You know, like with our pigs, it's a bit ridiculous. I mean, you know, we had 10 pigs running around on 64 acres. Like, it's not many people can do that, right? But we noticed the quality of the meat.
This is The Crackling. I'm Anthony Huckstep. A sustainable restaurant model, connecting with local producers and cooking delicious food, seems like commonplace more and more. But for chef Evan Hayter, food is an extension of his restaurant story. And in eating it, you become part of his mission to give back to the land that provides so much. Evan, we talk about sustainability with food and restaurants, but you're really living, breathing example of how far you can push that.
Thanks. That's an awesome intro. You're taking me back already. We try to do the best that we can. I think it's all most chefs that I surround myself with try to do anyway.
Tell us a little bit about the restaurant and the story behind it.
The restaurant was established in 2011. In February, it opened. I came on board about a year later. I've been part of the business now for 5 years. But the restaurant itself operates entirely off-grid. We're not connected to mains power at all. We treat all of our wastewater. All of our green waste goes to either composting or to the pigs. It has its challenges, obviously. Losing power in the middle of a busy Saturday service or something like that, because we do operate entirely off-grid, so no mains connection at all. It has its challenges, definitely.
Tell us about some of those challenges, especially in setting that up and working in that manner.
Well, I guess the technology's come a long way in the last 12 years. We operated on some pretty old batteries for a long time. Really the early days of the off-grid kind of operating. And we had to manage the load is probably the best way of putting it. So you, on a Saturday, you've got everything running, all your fridges, all your freezers, front of house, heating, cooling water, you name it, dishwashers, all these little things that you just sort of take for granted and, turning on a RoboCoop or something like that. And not overloading the system, because then it just shuts down and then it's half an hour to turn it all off, reboot it and get it going again. So it's, it's good fun though. You learn a lot.
You'd like to sort of explain yourself as farmers first, as opposed to a restaurant and cellar door. What are you growing there and what's happening on the land?
As far as the veggies and fruit that we produce, we're quite specific about what we like to grow. We're very lucky in our region, and within, say, an hour and a half's drive of where we are located, we can pretty much get anything you could ever need or ever want. And there's always someone that grows it better than you. If it's, and tomatoes, for example, they've just finished up for us. Our tomatoes are pretty good, so we grow them. Carrots, beetroots, things like that, that require a lot more depth in soil, and people that have been, growing organically or biodynamically for a lot longer than I have produce far better carrots and beetroots. So I like to source those things from people that produce it better than I do. It's not worth, my time to try to claim to be as good as them. So
you've forged some pretty amazing connections with local growers and farmers. Tell us about pig farmers. What sort of relationships have you fostered there?
Well, we farm our own pigs. They're a saddleback Duroc cross. And so they're born on the property and raised and we look after them every day and give them belly rubs and, you know, all those other things, all the things that pigs need.
Take us into the life of the pigs on the farm. What sort of environment are they growing in?
So Aramea is about 135 acres. So there's quite a lot of land for the pigs to roam on. We like to move them around. I mean, originally I got the pigs in the first place because of a extremely invasive weed called the arum lily. It's coming from Africa, and it's it just takes over waterways. And the only way of kind of controlling that was to spray it with really, really, toxic agricultural sprays. And it killed everything, as well as the arum lily. And it's your responsibility as a property owner to manage these lilies. But no one does, because no one sort of polices it. But I just tried to come up with a better way of doing it rather than spraying them. And I found out that pigs are pretty tolerant of these things, and actually they love digging them up. And we go along and pick up the bulbs afterwards and burn them off. And so it started as a kind of regeneration project, and the byproduct of that is delicious pork. So the pigs are as much of, you know, our story as any of us. They're just as important.
tell us about their life cycle there, and has that changed as you sort of try and get the best product that lands on the plate as well?
Yeah, definitely. The life cycle of our pigs. We have one sow and we have one boar. The boar lives on another farm. He's a Duroc boar, and our sow is gorgeous girl. She was born on the property about 5 years ago, and she's Duroc saddleback, and she's a big brown pig, big floppy ears, and like I say, she's absolutely gorgeous. She roams around on about 64 acres at the moment, and basically we get her and pig, and then there's the gestation, and then the piglets are born, we raise them, and they take about a year to get to where we like them before we send them off for that one day. It's always sad.
Well, after that one day, and you get them back in the kitchen, but what do you do with a whole pig, and how do you utilize that across the menu?
Yeah, I mean, they get used in all sorts of different processes. All the fat. A lot of that shoulder fat goes into lardo. We'll do big batches of, say, pork ragu. Currently our kids' meal is it's a pork ragu pasta, essentially, and it's made with great West Australian certified organic flour, eggs from our chickens, and then it's pork ragu, which is made from tomatoes from the garden, olive oil off the property, biodynamic onions, and our pork, which is, I believe, sensational. So,
take us back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play for you and your family?
It wasn't that important, actually. My parents are both in teaching. Grew up in Karratha, and our regular night was my mother cooking just, you know, your meat and three veg kind of dishes. You'd have it was good food, not exceptional, but good.
When did you start to get interested in food and see that as a potential career?
I left school just into year 11. I just wasn't enjoying school at all. I was absolutely acing maths, but I couldn't do English to save myself. It didn't leave me too many options. I had a cousin who had a restaurant, and he said, come and come and wash some dishes and hang out in the kitchen and you might enjoy it. So I went and did that for 2 weeks and, yeah, I absolutely loved it. I'm not sure. It's, you know, we all get pretty addicted to it, I guess. It's a pretty hectic place. There's lots of pressure and I didn't mind it at all. Really enjoyed it. And it was something completely different to anything that I'd done. So I finished my 2 week stint with him and then I went back to school for a week and wasn't enjoying it. And I basically signed up to TAFE and the rest was sort of history, I guess. I started cooking and got an apprenticeship a couple of months later just because TAFE ended up being too much like school as well. So I just wanted to work.
What were some of the really key sort of venues or people that influenced you in the early years as a chef?
I was quite lucky that I when I started my apprenticeship, I started at a restaurant called Dear Friends, which is in the Swan Valley, just outside of Perth. And my head chef then, his name was Philip Soir. He was just the most the loveliest Singaporean chef, and he'd basically moved to the Swan Valley for the simple life. He'd won multiple culinary Olympic gold medals with the Singaporean team. He'd worked all over the world, been in France for years and years. He spoke fluent French, Mandarin, English, and he was just a really gentle character. And I think I spent 2 years at Dear Friends, and he showed me a lot. And it was, I was very lucky to have that as my first job. You know, I had friends working at other restaurants where they're having pans thrown at them, and I didn't have that. so I'm extremely grateful for it. And then from there, I moved on to the Subiaco Hotel, which was, again, one of probably the most inspirational chef that I've worked with was Brad Burton. And he, again, like a gentle giant, but you knew that you had to work hard. he had the team. The whole team was behind him, and it's pretty incredible. Different setting to Dear Friends. It was a fast-paced kitchen, and yeah, it was on. As soon as you walked in, it was on. There was no time to relax, and but it was an incredible experience.
How did the opportunity at Aramea arrive?
There was quite a I guess a devastating loss in my immediate family, which kind of sent me to travel. So my partner and I packed everything up and we went overseas for a few years. And when we returned, we were back in Perth, and Perth just didn't really feel like home anymore. So we were spending all of our weekends down in Margaret River, and we just went, bugger it. Let's move down there. We had a few friends living down here already. And, so we bought a house and I took a job in about the same week, and we got down here and just went for it, I guess. It was a difficult move, but it's worked out now.
You mentioned you spent a couple of years overseas. What sort of impact did that have on your cooking career?
I think from a produce point of view, a massive impact. I didn't really do the norm, I guess. I did fly into London and caught up with a couple of friends, but I then got on a boat and went to the Netherlands, of all places. My partner's in architecture, so it was a great opportunity for her. I wanted to work Michelin, and so we both got to sort of fulfill our dreams. We went and lived in The Hague, in Den Haag, and it was an incredible experience working in a kitchen that spoke very little English, living in quite a small city, I guess. It's an important city, but we really kind of immersed ourselves in the culture, and, you know, all of our friends were Dutch, and it was fantastic. The people were just incredible, and easy to get a job, and, yeah, it was... It was great. So I had a good experience.
Was life a little bit different in the kitchen compared to the kitchens you'd been used to?
Yeah, it was different. We do 5 split shifts a week. That wasn't too unusual to, you know, what I'd been doing back here. But our work day was probably 15 or 16 hours. And we lunch together. So I'd go to work, we'd do our prep for the morning, then we'd do the staff meal, and it was in a hotel, the restaurant that I worked at. And so everyone would sit down and have food together, and then we'd go play football for an hour across on the lawn, and then we'd be back into it and into service. And so I wasn't home very often during the days that I was working. So it was different, but I really, really enjoyed it. You never really thought about the time, and I'm sure most chefs kind of feel that as well. You know, like you're abroad, you're doing something completely different. You've got a guy coming to the back door with white truffles, or you name it. It's pretty different. So you're always doing something different, which keeps it fresh.
The off-grid nature of Aramea, has that had an impact on the way that you cook and the sort of food that you cook?
Yeah, I think so. Is my approach to produce and understanding better farming, the conversations that you can have with people, the relationships that you can build. I think everything changes as soon as you start to really understand how something is growing. And the time that it takes to get it there. With our pigs, it's a bit ridiculous. I mean, you know, we had 10 pigs running around on 64 acres. Like, it's not many people can do that, right? But we notice the quality of the meat. We also grow them out till they're about 13 months old before we send them off. And at 13 months, they are the same size as something that's, you know, it's been pushed, and they're 4 to 6 months old, and so that's pretty eye-opening. That comes down to vegetables. I've got an incredible grower who I've worked with for about 7 years, and you know, like, I think originally it's almost down to her that I started to, well, she got me looking at things a lot more different. So she's a biodynamic grower, certified biodynamic. She just grew these carrots, and I had these carrots, and I it was like I'd never eaten a carrot before. Like, it was so sweet and delicious, and it just made me think, man, we got no idea what we're doing. Like, we got no idea of good produce. And anyone who grows things themselves, you know, you have these moments always, don't you? You know, you go, geez, that basil was more basil-y than ever. You know, like, how is this possible? And so it's those little things, and that definitely changes the way that we approach our food. Absolutely.
Sustainability, whether on the farm or, you know, in a restaurant context, is sometimes put in the too hard basket for operators, and also think it's quite costly. With the experience that you have, are there some really easy steps that sort of operators could take?
Definitely. There's so much waste. I think we're all pretty aware of it. Waste in kitchens and in our industry. The use of plastics, things like that. Implementing little things like that. Anyone who takes single use plastics out of their kitchen, and it's actually such an easy change to make, but you all have to be on board. And then once you do that, you realize that there's something else that you can do. You realize that there's, you know, you can stop overfeeding people, or cut down on portion sizes, be more aware of, you know, what you're putting on a plate, what's coming back, if at all. And I mean, it's a balance, and, you know, running a business, you're striving not to waste anything, obviously, because it's so expensive to do what we do. There's definitely loads of little things. I mean, we only use rainwater. We wash dishes with rainwater. It's quite crazy. But we all have to be aware in the middle of summer if you know, we have to cut down on the numbers that we cook for, because we can't use too much water, right? Otherwise, we're going to run out. So you always have to be aware of those things. And our position is quite different, I think, to any other restaurant. But I mean, anyone that operates in this kind of way would understand it, even households, I guess. But yeah, there's always little things that you can do better. And I think as soon as you start down the road of the whole, I guess, sustainability, I don't know. We kind of do what we do because it's the right thing to do. So we just try to push ourselves and be better every day. And I've surrounded myself with chefs and whatnot that are quite like-minded, and they get it. They get it. And you just push them a little bit and we get there.
And tell us a little bit about your cooking. Do you have a pork dish or two that you can tell us about that sort of epitomizes sort of where you're at as a chef?
Oh, I mean, that kid's past is pretty cool. I mean, nothing kind of reflects our property more than the pork ragu. A pork dish that epitomizes what we stand for. I mean, the fact that the pigs are born and raised on the property. I think our approach to our pork is pretty. Anything we do with it is pretty special, but I wouldn't be able to pinpoint a specific dish. Maybe the lardo, maybe the smoked lardo, which we smoke with a bit of the pepi leaves, which are it's an endemic tree to our region, and it's just super, super strong peppermint flavor. And when you smoke with it, it's incredible. It gets into everything, but with the pork fat, it's really cool. It translates to the dishes really well. So, and then a lot of the charcuterie, like our prosciuttos and lomos and things like that that we produce are, we love it. It's such a connection. It's born on the property. Like we see the pigs every day. We're very, very lucky to have what we have.
You mentioned the charcuterie that you're making. Tell us a little bit about some of the products that you're making and the real successes that you've had there.
Successes, you have a few. It's I hear it with a lot of the chefs that come on your podcast. Actually, I talk about the successes and the failures, and you definitely have a few that you go, Ooh, I don't know what happened there, but let's work it out. Successes would be the prosciutto. The first time I successfully made prosciutto, I'm pretty happy. And I haven't really had a failure with the prosciutto as such, but it's just the time that it takes to make something like that. It's pretty satisfying when you cut it open and it's it's nice. I'm trying to think of, we make a lot of copper. We make a lot of lomo.
Can you tell us one of the processes of one of the favorite products that you have that you're making?
What have we done? I'm trying to think of the copper, the last copper that we did with coriander seed and anise myrtle. So the coriander seed was saved out of the garden and dried and ground up. So it's cured for about a month under a bit of pressure. And then it's rolled and hung for another couple of months, really, before we cut into it and have a little look at it. But we found that those two flavors penetrated the meat really, really well. And with our pigs, I mean, they're not really old animals. Traditionally you'd use old sows or boars for making a lot of the charcuterie. But we find that there's quite a lot of flavor in it, in the meat, a lot of marbling. So we get a really waxy finish on our coppers in particular. So they're pretty satisfying.
Pigs are really at the heart of lots of what you do there. Do you have any tips or tricks on getting the best sort of roast pork or crackling?
Definitely hanging the animal when we first receive it back split. We hang the halves for about a week before we break them down. And I find that if you can leave the pig for a week to, I don't know, 9 or 10 days, just to dry out that skin, that little bit, that really does help with it. And then, I mean, everyone's got a little bit of a different thing that they do, I guess, with their crackling. If it's our belly, or even our shoulder, sometimes we like to just cook it in a little bath of pork stock, probably just an inch of pork stock in a tray, cover it with a lid, and just stick that in the oven for, you know, an hour and a half, and then we'll remove the lid, score the skin, salt the skin, let it sit for about an hour, and then we'll go back in to roast it and slowly dry that out, and then up the heat, and away you go with crackling.
You've had a pretty sharp career change and doing some pretty incredible things there. What do you love about what you do?
I do love everything about it. It's always challenging. It's a pretty different role. The farming side of things is extremely rewarding and interesting. We farm. What have we got? We have trout in the winter. We have marron. There's 400 olive trees, so we press olive oil every 2 years, about 1,600 litres. We cure all the olives we use in the restaurant. We've obviously got the pigs. The garden's about an acre, and then the fruit orchard. 60 beehives. Yeah, so we've, you know, there's things, and the chefs all get involved with everything. So, yeah, there's always something happening, and I love it when I've got a really like-minded team, which is what we have right now. We've been so lucky in this last 12 months. It's it's incredible. It's been a real treat to see where we've gotten to in this last year, I reckon, with a good team.
Well, Evan, it's incredible what you've created there, and I'm very honoured to have you on the Crackling Day to hear your story. Please keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
It was my pleasure. Pleasure. Thanks, Anthony.
This is The Crackling, a Deep in the Weeds production in partnership with Porkstar. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we catch up with some of Australia's best chefs and pork producers to discover what makes Australian pork so special.